Now we're still more than a year away from the 2020 presidential election, but already the race is in full swing. More than 20 Democratic hopefuls are competing for the opportunity to take on President Trump, and they've already met for two rounds of debates. It's easy to feel like presidential races drag on forever in this country, where as many other countries have tightly controlled campaign windows, the American presidential election seems to begin immediately after the previous election comes to a close. Our next guest says it didn't used to be this way and is here to explain how we got to this point. Rachel Payne Caulfield is a professor of political science at Drake University, and her recent piece for the website The Conversation is How Did the Presidential Campaign Get to Be So Long? Rachel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, you are in Iowa, ground zero for any candidate seeking the presidency. No big surprise that this might feel very immediate for you. Do you feel like you are living in a never-ending presidential campaign?
I certainly do. And quite literally, we are living in a never-ending presidential campaign at this point.
And you say that it has not always been this way, but it really does feel like the modern presidential campaign starts immediately after the previous election comes to a close. There is immediately, well, who's going to position themselves for 4 years from now? And while no candidate officially announces right away, moves are made to fundraise, build name recognition, put campaign teams together, how much is going on behind the scenes before a candidate can even begin a real campaign?
Well, a lot of this is going on behind the scenes long before the public starts paying attention. And, you know, I'm reminded of right after the 2004 election, literally within 2 weeks of the general election, John Kerry was back out in Iowa meeting with activists, kind of figuring out if maybe he wanted to do it again. So candidates, once the general election happens, the next round of candidates immediately starts thinking about how they want to position themselves, how they want to talk about issues, what kind of support they would have in the early states, what kind of agenda they want to set, who they need on their team. So it starts much before most people pay attention. Nonetheless, you know, now we're seeing all across the country people are very much paying attention and tuning into debates, and we are 400-plus days away from the general election.
No, actually, from personal experience, that the United States is a bit of an anomaly here. I have been in France during a presidential election, and you could almost not know that it was going on. Can you give us a sense how other countries handle election campaigns and how much time they set aside for them?
Sure. So in general, most countries that hold national elections, they generally don't last more than 2 months' time. Canada had a very long election by Canadian standards. It lasted about 75 days. And a lot of people started to get concerned about that and saying, this is just, you know, we've gone around the bend. These are long elections now, but they average about 50 days in Canada. In France, it lasts about 2 weeks. Japan restricts campaigns to just 12 days. And then, you know, Mexico, which is a little bit closer to the U.S. system in that they have a presidentialist system, so they might be expected to pay more attention to the selection of their chief executive. But they have 90 days for the presidential campaign, and they have a 60-day preseason where they select candidates. It's kind of what we would consider a nomination campaign. So the U.S. is really very different than most other democracies.
Well, and besides the amount of time, there is also the element of how many ways the campaigns or the candidates are getting in front of the voters, because again, I'll refer to France because it's the one I know the best. Mm-hmm. There are no television ads. And when I've tried to explain political robocalls to people, they look at me like I'm not from this planet. So that's part of it too, is it's very controlled.
Yeah, so what has happened over time in the United States is that we have enacted a series of reforms that have democratized the process. They've aimed to bring more and more people into the party's selection of its nominee. And, you know, they had the laudable goal of really spreading around the influence. So a lot of different kinds of voters now get to participate in a very public process. But in doing that, what it means is campaigns are incentivized to go out and to reach as many people as possible. And the way they do that is through advertising. Advertising requires money, of course, through free media. So they might try to make statements and kind of be out front on national issues, which we're seeing right now in the wake of the mass shootings over the weekend. They might engage in targeted Facebook ads, right? And I have to tell you, as an Iowa voter, I've already received 4 or 5 text messages today from campaigns encouraging me to attend events and meet their candidates. So they become very targeted at reaching out to as many people as possible. They have to be very savvy, and they have to have mass appeal now very early in the process.
Rachel Payne Caulfield is with us. She's a professor of political science at Drake University, and we are talking about the topic of her recent piece for the website The Conversation, that is, how did the presidential campaign get to be so long? And Rachel, you say it wasn't always this way, so can you take us back to earlier days of American elections? What did they look like then?
Sure. At the very beginning, candidates were selected by members of the party who were in Congress. It was called the Congressional Caucus or the King Caucus. And there was no public campaign at all. And that quickly shifted to this national convention system. So party leaders from all the different states would gather at a convention and select the party nominee. These were the days of the so-called smoke-filled rooms, right, where the elites would get together and make a decision about who the best standard bearer for the party would be. And then, you know, as we moved into the middle of the 20th century, states started to experiment with a much more public primary process rather than these party elite gatherings. And so that the primary became much more important, and campaigns started engaging in advertising and direct voter outreach much more. But even by 1952, Dwight Eisenhower on one side of the aisle, he didn't even announce that he was a Republican until 10 months before the general election. And when he did, he said, yeah, I might be willing to be president, but he didn't declare a candidacy. And then it wasn't until June, before the general election, he resigned as NATO commander and came back to actually campaign. So, you know, a very short campaign for him. And then on the Democratic side, Adlai Stevenson had been encouraged to run for president by the president, President Truman, and he repeatedly rejected those efforts. He said, nope, don't want to be drafted into this race. I don't want nothing to do with it. But he gave a speech at the opening of the convention, and the delegates got so excited about him that they chose him as the nominee. So it wasn't until the party convention that they chose the nominee. So very different environment than the one that we expect today.
Well, and speaking of conventions, some listeners may remember the Democratic Convention of 1968 or have heard about it. It was very contentious. Tens of thousands of protesters on the streets of Chicago, riots, bloodshed. You say that led to a series of reforms. How did the 1968 Democratic Convention affect that nomination process?
Well, first of all, for anyone who's interested in kind of figuring out why our elections work the way they do, if you go back to the late 60s and early 70s, there are just a whole series of reforms that went into effect right around that time period and in reaction to a lot of different events. But the 68 convention was so contentious, and the Democratic Party, you know, even if we set aside all the moral and kind of party questions that came out of that convention, there was a big public relations problem that the party faced in that it had a lot of young, energized anti-war protesters who supported Eugene McCarthy, who had protested in the streets of Chicago as Hubert Humphrey was nominated, and Mayor Daley's police force came out and to quell those protests, and it ended up being very violent. It was on TV screens all across the country, and so the Democratic Party formed a committee and said, okay, how are we going to solve this? How are we going to make our process more accessible to a wider range of people? And they put into effect a series of reforms, the McGovern-Fraser reforms, after that 68 convention. And those reforms were really designed to make it easier for people to participate. If you lived in a caucus state like Iowa, you had to have local caucuses, so they were easy to attend. And a lot of state party organizations said, this is a huge logistical nightmare, so we're just going to switch over to primaries. We're going to, you know, have the state run these things, and it's going to be easy, easy for people to participate. And in doing that, it created an environment where campaigns now really did have to go out, and they had to use any tool at their disposal to gain support from as many people as possible. So it wasn't enough to just, you know, spend time with and convince the party leaders. You now had to get the rank and file voters to like you. And that meant a lot of time and effort. It meant a lot of strategic use of media, a lot of fundraising. And all of a sudden, you had a very different election environment that came out of that series of reforms.
Well, and another change, Rachel, it sounds like was, as you said, being in Iowa, you are constantly being campaigned at. Mm-hmm. New Hampshire is in a similar situation, and that came out of Jimmy Carter's success.
It did. So one of the things, after those 68 reforms were enacted, Iowa had already changed its caucus system to make it more local, and so they started mapping back from the national convention to find out when they would need to hold these local caucuses. And it turned out that Iowa would have to hold these local caucuses really early in the process, in fact, before New Hampshire. And New Hampshire has had the first in the nation primary for a decade, for a century, sorry. And so Iowa all of a sudden went before New Hampshire. In 1972, McGovern, who had written these rules, McGovern paid some attention to Iowa, did fairly well, but was not considered to be a big victor. And then in 1976, Jimmy Carter said, you know what, if I can bet everything on Iowa and I can go out there and knock on doors and meet with people in their workplaces and in their, you know, in their restaurants and diners and really get to know them and let them get to know me, I can do well in Iowa. And that in turn will provide a great deal of momentum for my campaign going forward. And that's exactly what he did. And so that mythology of Iowa then became a really big deal. And more candidates sought to emulate that by coming to Iowa very early on in the process to build that person-to-person contact that would allow them to do well in the early states.
We're talking right now about how modern American presidential campaigns became so long. Rachel Payne Caulfield is our guest. She's a professor of political science at Drake University. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are presidential campaigns too long, in your opinion? Or does a longer campaign make you feel more engaged and help you cast an informed vote? What do you think would improve presidential campaigns? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Rachel Payne Caulfield. She's a professor of political science at Drake University, and we're talking about how the presidential campaign season became so long in the United States, especially compared to other countries. And you can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. In advance of the 2020 election, do you have campaign fatigue already? Are these campaigns too long or just about right? Could anything be done to speed them up? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Rachel James on Facebook wrote, we should have a federal law requiring all presidential primaries and caucuses to be held on the same day, preferably sometime in July of the election year. Is that a viable option for cutting down the election length?
Well, so I think, first of all, this is a pretty common proposal to say, okay, we're just going to do this nationally. One of the things, you know, when we talk about any reform, we have to think about not only what the benefits would be, one of which might be a shorter campaign season, but also what are the unintended consequences. And one of the things that we've seen this with front-loading, as more and more states have moved their races up, is that when candidates have to compete in a lot of states all at the same time, and that's certainly what would happen under some form of a national primary or a national day of primaries, it means that candidates essentially would have to start a national campaign straight out of the gate. They'd have to be ready to run in every single state. And I suspect that what a lot of candidates would do is they would come earlier and earlier and start raising more and more money because it costs a lot to run a national election. So I think they depend more heavily on media, even more than they do now. That requires a lot of money. So they'd be seeking money very early in the process.
And Johan on Facebook wrote, the campaign might be long, but with all these candidates, you want to be sure all of them get time to say what their plans are. That's just how fairness works. Is there something to be said for, especially when, you know, we had 24 Democrats at first, is there something to be said for making sure voters have a chance to learn about them?
Well, I think everybody wants to know what the choices are in a campaign. And one of the things that's been unique about these debates is that we've seen so many candidates so early on, and a lot of people across the country, they're not accustomed to seeing that many voices on stage at a time. Part of that's because we have such a huge field of Democrats running this cycle, and part of it's simply because we're airing debates on a national level earlier and earlier in the process. And so, I think it's worth hearing all of those voices. There is a plan in place as the debates continue. The thresholds will get higher and higher. So there's a plan in place to start to winnow that field and get an idea of who's a viable candidate and who's not. And I think at this point, so many people felt overwhelmed by those debates that it gives you a good idea about exactly how diverse the ideas within a single party can be.
Is the 2020 presidential campaign likely to be the longest we've seen to date? And is it possible for them to get even longer in the future?
It's possible for them to get longer in the future. There's always a little gamesmanship between Iowa and New Hampshire to potentially, you know, go earlier and earlier for several cycles now. There's been some speculation that Iowa may end up having to go in the year prior to the general election. That hasn't happened, and the parties have kind of tamped down on that. But certainly, you know, if a candidate or a potential candidate is starting to think about the possibility of running, they want every advantage they can get, and they want it as early as possible. And just as evidence of that, you know, John Delaney, this time around, he actually announced his bid for the White House before the midterm elections occurred. So he has been out in Iowa now for a year and a half talking to Iowa voters, and that's a remarkable shift. We've not seen anything quite like that before.
Let's go to the phones, and Oliver in Madison is up. Hi, Oliver.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
So my comment was this. I thought was to take the national census data, then break it down a step so that you would have it by state, then choose the state every 10 years that is most reflective of the country as a whole to go first. So it wouldn't always be Iowa.
Hmm.
This would also allow the candidates to find out how they're actually going to do on a mass scale that's representative of the national numbers.
That's an interesting idea, Oliver. Is that something that you've heard a version of before, Rachel?
Well, there's always kind of this conversation about how to choose a representative state. And there are, I think, a lot of good reasons to think about how can we set up a process that accurately represents the wide and incredibly diverse range of viewpoints within the American political system. One of the reasons, you know, I live in Iowa, so obviously I'm a big fan of the Iowa caucuses, but I'm a little biased on this front, I'll admit that. But I also think, you know, most states in the United States right now are not competitive from a partisan perspective. Iowa remains competitive. Any ideology can find a home here in Iowa. So candidates that might seem nationally to be representative of some characteristics, in most states in the country, they actually don't have much of a fighting chance because of the nature of partisan politics in so many states. And I would also just note there are a lot of states that are very demographically diverse and very representative of the population at large. But there are states that have very big media markets. There are states where candidates would really rely on media much more. That just changes the way, it changes the kind of candidate who will be successful in the process. And so I think anytime we talk about these reforms, we need to think about whether or not they will achieve our intended, intended effects, but whether they also have some potential unintended effects.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a really interesting conversation.
Well, thank you.
Rachel Payne Caulfield is a professor of political science at Drake University. Her recent piece for the website, The Conversation, is How Did the Presidential Campaign Get to Be So Long? You can share your thoughts on that topic over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let us know if you think it's too long, too short, or just right.